Chapter 4. Carl Becker restlessly paced the deck of the Danish research vessel Thor. Shoulders hunched, hands thrust into the pockets of his great coat, the Navy bureaucrat looked like a large, wingless bird. Becker wore several layers of clothing, yet he shivered as his thoughts went back to the collision. He had been shoved into a lifeboat, only to be thrown into the freezing water when the overloaded craft capsized during launch. If a Faroese trawler had not plucked his semi-conscious body to safety, he would have been dead within minutes. He stopped to light a cigarette, cupping his hands around the flame, and leaned on the rail. As he stared bleakly at the red plastic sphere that marked the grave of the sunken cruiser, he heard his name being called. The Thor's captain, Nils Larsen, was striding across the deck in his direction.
"Where are those damned Americans?" Becker growled.
"Good news. They just called," said the captain. "They expect to be here in 5 minutes."
"About time," Becker said.
Like his colleague on the Leif Erikson, Captain Larsen was tall and blonde with a craggy profile.
"In all fairness," he said, "it's only been a matter of hours since the cruiser went down. The NATO response team needed a minimum of 72 hours to place a mothership, crew, and rescue vehicle on site. The Numa people have lived up to their pledge to get here within 8 hours. They deserve some leeway."
I know, Becker said, more in exasperation than anger. "I don't mean to be ungrateful, but every minute counts."
He flicked the cigarette butt into the sea and jammed his hands even further into his pockets.
"Too bad Denmark no longer has capital punishment," he fumed. "I'd like to see that whole murderous SOS bunch swing from the end of a rope."
"You're sure they deliberately rammed you?"
"No doubt of it. They changed course and came directly at us. Bang! Like a torpedo."
He glanced at his watch.
"You're sure the Americans said 5 minutes? I don't see any ships approaching."
"That is puzzling," the captain said.
He raised his binoculars and scanned the horizon.
"I don't see any vessels either."
Hearing a noise, he pointed the lenses toward the overcast sky.
"Wait, there's a helicopter coming this way. It's moving very fast."
The pencil point speck grew rapidly larger against the slate gray cloud cover, and before long the thrump thrump of rotors was audible. The aircraft made directly for the Thor and buzzed the ship slightly higher than mast level, then it banked and went into a wide circle around the research vessel. The letters NUMA were clearly visible in big, bold letters on the side of the turquoise Bell 212. The ship's first mate trotted across the deck toward the captain and pointed to the circling chopper.
"It's the Americans. They're asking permission to land."
The captain replied in the affirmative, and the crewman relayed the okay into a squawking hand radio. The helicopter swooped in, hovered above the stern deck, and descended in slow motion, making a gentle landing at the exact center of the white circle that marked the helipad. The door flew open and two men emerged under the spinning rotors and made their way across the deck. As a politician, Becker was an acute observer of people. The men moved with the casual easiness that he had seen in other Americans, but their determined stride and the way they carried themselves projected an air of supreme confidence. The broad-shouldered man leading the way was just over 6 feet tall and around 200 pounds, Becker estimated. He had steel-gray, almost platinum hair, but as the man drew near, Becker saw that he was young, probably around 40. His dark-complexioned companion was slightly shorter, younger, and slimmer. He walked with the panther-like grace of a boxer, which would not have surprised Becker if he had known the man had financed his way through college fighting as a middleweight. His movements were relaxed, but with the inherent energy of a coiled spring. The captain stepped forward to greet the Americans.
"Welcome to the Thor," he said.
"Thanks. I'm Kurt Austin from the National Underwater and Marine Agency," said the husky man, who looked as if he could walk through a wall. "And this is my partner, Joe Zavala."
He shook hands with the captain, then Becker, almost bringing tears to the Dane's eyes with a crushing handshake.
Zavala pulverized those bones Austin had missed.
You made good time, the captain said.
We're a few minutes behind schedule, Austin said. The logistics were somewhat complicated.
That's all right.
Thank God you came, Becker said, rubbing his hand. He glanced toward the helicopter.
Where's the rescue team?
Austin and Zavala exchanged an amused glance.
You're looking at it, Austin said.
Becker's astonishment gave way to barely restrained fury. He whirled around to face the captain.
How in God's name are these two gentlemen going to rescue Captain Peterson and his men?
Captain Larson was wondering the same thing, but was more reserved.
I suggest you ask them, he replied with obvious embarrassment at Becker's outburst.
Well, Becker said, glaring first at Austin, then Zavala. Becker could not have known that the two men who had stepped off the helicopter equaled a shipload of rescuers. Born in Seattle, Austin had been raised in and around the sea, which was not surprising, since his father was the owner of a marine salvage company. While studying for his master's degree in systems management at the University of Washington, he'd attended a highly rated Seattle dive school where he'd attained proficiency in a number of specialized areas. He'd put his expertise to work on North Sea oil rigs, worked for his father a while, then been hired by the CIA to conduct underwater intelligence. When the Cold War ended, he'd been recruited by Sandecker to head the special assignments team. Zavala was the son of Mexican parents who had waded across the Rio Grande, settling in Santa Fe. His oil-stained mechanical genius was the stuff of legend around the halls of NUMA, and he could repair, modify, or restore any kind of engine ever devised. He had spent thousands of hours as a pilot in helicopters, small jet, and turboprop craft. His assignment to Austin's team had proved a fortunate pairing. Many of their assignments would never become public knowledge, but their wisecracking camaraderie in the face of danger masked a steely determination and a competence few could rival. Austin calmly regarded Becker with piercing blue-green eyes the color of coral underwater. He was not unsympathetic to Becker's plight and deflected the Dane's fury with a broad smile.
Sorry for being flip. I should have explained immediately that the rescue vehicle is on its way.
Should be here in about an hour, Zavala added.
There's a lot we can do in the meantime, Austin said. He turned to the captain. I need help unloading a piece of equipment from the chopper. Can you spare a few men with strong backs?
Yes, of course.
The captain was relieved to be doing something at last. Moving with crisp efficiency, he dispatched his first mate to round up the work detail. At Austin's direction, the grunting crewman lifted a large wooden crate from the helicopter's storage compartment and set it down on the deck. Using a crowbar from the helicopter, Austin pried the top off the box and peered inside. After a quick inspection, he said, "Everything looks ship-shape. What's the latest on the situation?" Captain Larson pointed to the bobbing buoy that marked the sunken cruiser. While Austin and Zavala listened intently, Larson provided a quick summary of the collision and sinking.
It doesn't make sense, Austin said.
From what you say, they had plenty of sea room.
So did the Andrea Doria and the Stockholm, Zavala said, referring to the disastrous sea collision off Nantucket. Becker mumbled something about SOS criminals, but Austin ignored him and concentrated on the business at hand.
What makes you so sure the captain and his men are still alive?
We were doing a whale population survey not far from here when we got the call for help, Larson said. We dropped a hydrophone over the side and picked up the sound of someone tapping an SOS on the hull in Morse code. Unfortunately, we can only receive, not send, messages. However, we determined that there were 13 men, including Captain Anderson, trapped in a pocket of air in the forward bunkroom. The air is foul, and they were in the early stages of hypothermia.
When did you last hear from them?
About 2 hours ago. It was essentially the same message, only the tapping has become much fainter. Toward the end, they tapped out the same word over and over.
What was it?
Desperate.
Austin broke the grim silence that followed. Did you get any other equipment down to the ship? The Faroese Coast Guard called the NATO base on Stremoy. They contacted the NATO Submarine Rescue Network minutes after the cruiser went down. Those ships you see out there are mostly from Scandinavian countries. We've been acting as the interim mother ship. A Swedish vessel should arrive soon with a rescue vehicle, but like the others, it's useless in this situation. It's set up to rescue men through a submarine rescue hatch. We've been able to pinpoint the cruiser's location 260 feet down, but beyond that, for all our technical ability, we're only spectators at a disaster in the making.
Not necessarily, Austin said. Then you think you can help, Becker said with pleading eyes.
Maybe, Austin said. We can say better after we see what we're up against. Becker apologized for his earlier abruptness.
Sorry I flew off the handle. We're grateful for your offer to help. I owe a special debt to Captain Peterson. After we were hit and there was no doubt the cruiser would sink within minutes, he made sure I had a place in a lifeboat. When he learned others were still below, he rushed off to help them and must have been trapped when the ship sank.
He's a brave man. All the more reason for saving him and his crew, Austin said. Do you have any idea of the ship's position on the bottom?
Yes, of course. Come with me, the captain said.
He led the way to an electronics lab off the main deck. The room was equipped with computer monitors used for remote sensing projects.
This is a high-resolution sonar picture of the Leif Erikson, he said, indicating the image on a large monitor. As you can see, she is lying at a slight angle on an inclined slope. The crew's quarters are here, one deck below the mess area, a short distance back from the bow. Obviously, air was trapped here.
He circled a section of hull with the cursor.
It's a miracle they're still alive.
It's a miracle they may wish never happened, Becker observed glumly. Tell us about the compartment.
It's quite large. There are bunks for 24 crewmen. It's reached by a single companionway through the mess hall. There's also an emergency hatch.
We'll need specific details about the bunk room, particularly the location of pipes, conduits, and structural supports.
The captain handed over a file. The Navy Department faxed this material to us in anticipation of the rescue attempt. I think you'll find everything you need. If not, we can get it to you quickly.
Austin and Zavala studied the ship's schematic layouts, then went back to the sonar image.
There's only so much we can learn from pictures, Austin said finally. Maybe it's time I went for a swim.
Good thing you brought your swimsuit, Zavala said.
It's the new Michelin model. Guaranteed to wow the girls.
Becker and the captain wondered if they had stumbled into the company of madmen. They exchanged puzzled glances, then hurried to keep up with the Numa men. While Zavala sketched out their strategy for Captain Larson and Becker, Austin supervised the four strapping crewmen as they moved the crate until it was under a boom. They unwound cable from the crane, then Austin ran it into the big box and gave the signal to start the hoist. The bright yellow figure that rose from the crate was nearly 7 feet tall and looked like a robot in a 50s sci-fi film. The cast aluminum arms and legs did indeed bulge like those of the Michelin Man, and the helmet resembled an oversized fishbowl. The arms ended in pinchers like those of an insect. Four small fans protected by circular housings projected from the elbows and the back of the arms. Austin rapped his knuckles against the unit pack attached to the figure's back. This is the latest in hard suit technology. This model can operate at depths of 2,000 feet for up to 6 hours, so I'll have plenty of leeway. Mind if I borrow a short ladder? I'll need an experienced boat crew in the water, too. The captain dispatched his first mate to carry out the requests. Austin stripped off his windbreaker, pulled a heavy wool sweater over his turtleneck jersey, and yanked a blue navy watch cap down over his ears. The suit broke at the waist into two sections. Austin climbed the ladder and eased his body into the bottom pod. Then the top section was attached, the lifting line attached, and the boom slowly lifted him off the deck. Using the suit's radio, which was the same frequency as the ship's handsets, he called a halt when he was a few feet above the deck. He moved his arms and legs, aided by 16 hydraulically compensated rotary joints. Then he tried out the manually operated manipulators at the end of each hand pod. Finally, he tried the foot pad controls and listened to the whir of the vertical and horizontal thrusters. "All systems go," Austin said. The atmospheric diving suit, or ADS, had been developed to protect divers from intense ocean pressures while allowing them to carry out tasks of relative delicacy. Despite its humanoid shape, the hard suit was considered a vehicle and the diver referred to as its pilot. With Zavala supervising the operation, the boom pivoted over the water. Austin swung back and forth like a yo-yo at the end of its swing. Seeing that the launch crew had its boat in the water, he said, "Lower away." The cable paid out and Austin dropped into the heaving swells. Green froth surged over his helmet. The boat crew detached the cable fastening and Austin sank like a stone for several fathoms until he adjusted the suit to neutral buoyancy. Then he played with the thrusters, moving up, down, back and forward, then into a hover. He took a last look at the pale surface glimmering above him, switched on the lights on the chest section, mashed the vertical control pad, and began his descent.